Hello and welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message given by Lee Younger on May 13th, 2012, from the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. All right, well, we're going to be, if anybody wants to follow along in your Bibles, or I guess some people you have Bible apps, you can navigate to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. That's where we'll be. You know, I've been thinking about pregnancy all week. And I don't think I'm pregnant or anything. I haven't been dreaming about it or anything like that. But I've been thinking about pregnancy and birth all week. One reason, because, of course, Devin and Aaron are about to have a baby and at any moment. And for, you know, the rest of you that haven't been by to ask him yet, no, they haven't had the baby yet. Everything's fine. Everything's going great. But so that's one reason is I've just been kind of walking alongside them as they're waiting on their little girl to arrive. And another reason is just it's Mother's Day. You know, I've been kind of ramping up for Mother's Day, getting ready for it. And Mother's Day for me, it was the Mother's Day, you know, kind of represents the three times in my life where Christy, who was always, ever since I met her, she was always my favorite person. Mother's Day represents the time when my favorite person became like my superhero. You know, it was just these three times that somebody went from being the coolest person I knew to being my absolute all-out hero, where I was like, that was the coolest thing I've ever personally witnessed in my life, three times over. And for those of you who have had kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's funny, though, pregnancy is one of those weird things that gives everybody kind of a license that they maybe shouldn't have. You know, like if a woman is like really, really pregnant, it makes everybody else in her life feel like it's suddenly okay for them to touch her body, just to go up and touch her stomach. You know, it's like, this is not something you do in real life. Like, I've never been to a restaurant and one of my friends walked up that was meeting me there. You know, they didn't ever walk up to me and just, like, touch my stomach. Hey, how are you doing? You know, this is not something that happens. This is not something that people do. But all of a sudden, when a woman is, like, excessively pregnant in the late stages of pregnancy, everybody, not even just friends, like, complete strangers just come up and touch their body. It's like, I'm sorry, I don't know you. I'm not sure that we would be friends. And you have your hands on my body. That's very odd. You know, it's one of those things where people have, they feel the right to just ask questions about you that are really kind of, you know, really kind of intimate questions. You can't be just asking me questions like that. I was talking to Erin recently and she was saying that she wished she had a t-shirt that said, no, I haven't had the baby yet. And then on the back, and no, I don't know when I'm going to get induced. So leave me alone. You know, and it's like, it's one of those things where like, and it's one of those deals where like family that are out of town will call and say, do you have the baby yet? It's like, yeah, mom, had the baby about a week and a half ago. I was going to send you some pictures next month. It's like, what? Of course we didn't. I would call you. You know, it's just one of those, it's like, it's one of those weird things. It causes people to ask strange questions, to like to touch you with no provocation. It's a really, really bizarre thing, but you know, for me, when our babies were born, that was the most. These three events were the most singular events that I've ever personally witnessed. You know, when Anna was born, we were just kids ourselves. You know, we were so young, and all of a sudden, we had this little baby, and we've been waiting on her, and we've been thinking about her and praying for her, and you know, we got her room already and all that kind of stuff, and we named her and everything, and then all of a sudden, in this one moment, you hear that little noise. You hear that noise of that baby crying. It doesn't sound like, there's nothing else in the world that sounds like a newborn cry. And then we saw her, and it was like, I am forever changed. Right here in this moment. And there she is. And it was like touching her, holding her for the first time. And you just want to say to her, there you are. Like, we made a bedroom for you. I know you don't know what that is yet, but you're really going to like it, you know? And we have these clothes for you. And I know you don't know what that means yet, but they're really cute. And we have toys. And I know you have no dexterity yet, but one day you're going to really like them, you know? And it's just all these things that your head is filled with. And when Nora was born, a lot of you guys know this, but when Nora was born, Christy was in labor for 53 and a half hours. And I don't mean like early labor and stuff like that, and then you add active labor, and then you add it all together. I mean active labor, the hard part. The part in the movies where the people are screaming, and then the woman is looking at the husband with looks of, I will kill you soon. That 53 and a half hours, like 2+ days. And I realized during that time that I've never done anything for 53 and a half hours all joined up, except breathing. That's the only thing. I couldn't eat for that long or play video games. I couldn't relax for that long. Cellular mitosis, that's the only thing I've done for 53 and a half hours. And she was in labor that long. And I remember that whole time just thinking, this woman is unbelievable. You know, and just through that process, just watching a superhero do her superhero thing. And then, you know, and it was one of those deals where it was just like, it was hard, and it was dark, and it was confusing, and it was painful, and there were tears and prayers, and just when you're about to reach like the end of everything you can do, then we'd reach another milestone. It was like, okay, we can keep going further and further, and it was like 2+ days of this. And then finally, when Nora came, I was like looking around the room, and there's nurses just kind of walking around doing their nurse thing, you know, calculating numbers and taking measurements and saying stuff. And I wanted to call a timeout over the whole thing and say, did anybody see that? That was the most awesome thing that's ever happened in all of human history. And this little baby was there. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately, not just because of Mother's Day and not just because Devin and Aaron are about to have their baby, but because of the scriptures that we've been talking about. Because, to be frank, the life of faith is a lot like birth. But it's not like giving birth. The life of faith, I've been thinking about this a lot, is a lot like getting born. It's like being the baby. It's like, it's kind of weird to say, but it's walking with Jesus is a lot like being in the birth canal. You're coming out. I mean, it's hard, it's dark, it's painful, it's confusing. There's a lot of noises happening everywhere. There's a lot of waiting sometimes. There's a lot of compression. There's a lot of anticipation. And it's disorienting. You don't know if what right side up is or anything like that. You feel like you're not able to breathe sometimes. And this is what it's like sometimes to walk with Jesus. It's like getting born. It's hard and it's hard and it's hard. And then at the end of it, you're delivered. We've been talking recently about the book of Hebrews. And the reason is because and a lot of you guys that have been here with us know this, that the book of Hebrews was written to the earliest kind of Christians who were all Jewish. Everybody that, when Jesus died and rose from the dead and then ascended into heaven, everybody that accepted Christ was a Jewish person. They were all that way. And as soon as people started accepting Jesus, their lives became very difficult all of a sudden, because their families and their friends and their bosses and stuff like that felt like you're abandoning like the thing that makes us who we are, thousands of years of tradition and family and everything and faith, and you're abandoning those things. And so these people that would accept Christ would lose their jobs, and they would lose their families, they would lose their friends. Accepting Jesus made their lives so difficult all of a sudden. And some of them started to have the feeling of, this is too hard. This is dark. It's painful. It's confusing. There's a lot of squeezing and disorienting, and there are tears and prayers, and I don't know where I am half the time. I think that the only way out of the dark is to just get out of the dark. And so a lot of them were just kind of turning loose of their faith in Jesus. And, you know, not many people, when they decide to leave the faith, they don't just kind of stand up in their whole family's face and say, that's it, I'm done with the Jesus thing, I'm out of here. What happens is that they slowly drift. They just kind of slowly let go. Slowly stop coming to Bible study. Stop kind of showing up to church. They stop hanging out with the friends of theirs who love the Lord, that pray with them, that are in the Word with them together. They kind of slowly stop being in the Word for themselves. They just kind of drift away. They just kind of slowly loosen their grip on this faith. And before you know it, they're just not really walking with the Lord at all anymore. And that's kind of what was happening. These guys' lives had become so difficult because of their faith in Jesus that they were drifting away. And the writer of the book of Hebrews, we don't know who it was. The writer of the book of Hebrews was basically writing this book to say, whatever you do, don't do that. Don't drift away. Don't quit. Don't slowly walk away from the family of God. Don't leave your friends in Christ. Don't walk away from this. Hang on. In fact, when it gets harder, you need to hang on tighter. You need to get your grip stronger. The thing you need is an anchor. You need to have tenacity in your faith. You could sum the whole book of Hebrews up in two words: don't quit. That's what it's about. And by the time we get to chapter 11, the author of the book of Hebrews is saying, look, I know you're having a hard time. You're not the first one. There are other people who had a hard time, and despite that, they hung on to their faith all the way through. And he basically just goes through the Old Testament and just starts naming people. He says, look at Enoch, and look at Noah, and look at Abraham, and look at Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses. And he just goes on naming all these people. And he basically says, remember how Abraham did this? Remember how Isaac did that? Remember how Jacob did that one thing? Remember Moses' life? And that would trigger things in the hearts and minds of these Jewish people who knew Jesus. And like inside jokes, they would say, oh yeah. And they would have something to hang on to. The reason that they needed to not give up on their faith. And so as we look at this, basically, when you're reading Hebrews chapter 11, the goal of it is to look back at these verses and say, if I was one of these Jewish people that was just having a hard time and just barely hanging on, if they were to mention this thing about Abraham or this thing about Moses, why would that make me want to hold on tighter? What is that little secret of having a tenacious faith? What is the inside joke that I'm not getting? And if I can figure that out, I'm going to hang on. So we're in Hebrews chapter 11. And the writer of the book of Hebrews in verses 28 and 29 says this. He's talking about Moses. Says this. By faith, he, Moses, by faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So he says, by faith, Moses kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that when the destroyer of the firstborn came, he didn't touch the firstborn of the Israelites. And by faith, the people walked through a lake on dry ground, even though when the Egyptians tried to do it, they were drowned. And I'm looking at that going, okay, what is it? Like, what's the little secret I'm supposed to understand that they got? Like, what was the trigger that just went off in their heads as soon as they heard that? What was the, oh yeah, moment for them? Now, I know a lot of you guys know all about kind of the Passover and the Red Sea. It's kind of basic Bible stories. I mean, you've at least seen probably that cartoon movie that came out about 10 or 12 years ago, The Prince of Egypt, that Steven Spielberg and some other folks did. I mean, everybody kind of knows this. These are the Bible stories that we all kind of grew up on, the Passover and the Red Sea. But I want to walk back through them just for a few minutes because it's really, really important that we're all on the same page. Because there's something in here that is so key. There's something in here that's so important that if you have your head and your heart around it, you'll hang on. You'll hang on to your faith in Christ no matter how dark and how confusing and how painful that thing you're walking through gets. So, okay, Passover and the Red Sea. So, basically, God looks at all of the human story and it's a mess. Everybody's walked away from him. Everybody's in rebellion. And he's like, the only way to rescue this thing, the only way to rescue these people is to send a rescuer. The only way to cover the guilt and the penalty of their wrong is for God himself to actually come down here and pay for it, to live a perfect life and then lay that life down as a sacrifice to pay the penalty of all that wrong. So God himself has to come as a person. He promised Eve he would do it in the very beginning, third chapter in the Bible. He promised he would do it. And then what he did was he decided he's going to do this by sending the rescuer into a nation of people on the earth. So he's got to make a nation. And he makes a nation out of a family. And he makes a family out of one guy. So he's got to pick one guy. And we know this. He picked this guy from Iraq, a guy named Abram. And he grabbed him and told him, I'm going to give you a land and I'm going to give you kids. And one of your descendants is going to rescue the whole world. And Abraham, he changed his name to Abraham. And Abraham's like, that sounds great, but I'm 75 years old. You know, 15 years later, still waiting. 100 years old. He finally has this baby. His wife, Sarah, has this baby, Isaac. And God promises Isaac, one of your kids, one of your descendants, is going to be the one who's going to rescue the whole world. So Isaac has two kids, Esau and then Jacob. God promises it's going to be one of Jacob's kids. So Jacob has 13 kids, 12 sons, one daughter. Nobody ever talks about the daughter. Her name was Dinah. She was pretty cool. But everybody just kind of skips her. There was the 12 sons. Okay, there's the 12 tribes of Israel. Because Jacob, his name was changed from Jacob to Israel after he had an all-night beatdown with God himself. And so the 12 tribes of Israel, and God promises, the rescuer of the whole world is going to come through the son whose name is Judah. But the story kind of diverts there because all the sons hated one son, Joseph. And they all decided, they're going to kill him. And they were like, well, we better not kill him. So instead of killing him, we're going to sell him to Midianite slave traders. Awesome. You know, so he gets sold to these Midianite slave traders who take him all the way down to Egypt and they sell him. And then he winds up becoming the prime minister of all of Egypt. And then he saved the whole world when the whole world had a drought and famine that lasted for 7 years because of his brilliant economic policies and the way that he had basically food pantries that he had built up for all this time. So he saves basically the whole world from just kind of going hungry. Part of that process was because the drought and famine affected where Jacob and the rest of his sons and their wives and everybody, it affected them as well. So he sent them down to get food. They found Joseph. Joseph found them. They all reunited. And Joseph said, I want all y'all to come down to Egypt and live here. I know the Pharaoh. I'm the prime minister. It's pretty fat down here. Come on, it's going to be awesome. So they do that. It was 70 people. Jacob, and who's now Israel, and all his sons, and all their wives, and all their kids. 70 people. So one guy became a family. A big family. And then they lived in this region in Egypt called Goshen that was just awesome. The Pharaoh said, you can just have this whole kind of county. You can have it to yourselves. And then basically, over the period of 430 years, 70 people became 2.5 million people. So a guy became a family who became a nation. And God said, these are my kids. These are my special kids. And I'm going to save the whole world through these kids. Now, the other thing that happened over the process of the 430 years was that the Pharaoh that loved Joseph died. Another Pharaoh came up. He didn't like Joseph as much. Then he died. Another Pharaoh came up. Joseph's long dead at this point. He didn't remember Joseph or any of them or the fact that Joseph had saved the world. He didn't read the hieroglyphs very well. I don't really know what the deal was there, but they all forgot about it. And he basically enslaved the entire Jewish nation. So the Jewish nation became the people that made the bricks for the, you know, for the pyramids and everything else. They built Israel. They became the back of the economy. This nation who came from a family, who came from a guy. God's kids. And God heard their crying. He heard their pleas. So he decided to send someone to rescue them. He sent Moses, who was an Israelite kid who had grown up in the palace of the Pharaoh. And then when he was 40 years old, decided he didn't want that anymore. And he went out into the desert to become a shepherd in the desert. He was there for 40 years. So at age 80, God sends him back. Which, by the way, they always kind of get this wrong. Like in Prince of Egypt, he looks like he's, what, 24 or something like that? The dude was 80 years old. Standing in the palace of the Pharaoh, the most powerful man on earth. And he says, okay, here's the deal. Your slaves are God's kids. So he wants them back. And you have to let them go. And Pharaoh said, God's kids are mine. My slaves. You can't have them. He can't have them. Only I can have them. And Moses said, okay, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. The easy way is you give God his kids back, and then you get to prosper and survive and all that kind of stuff. The hard way is that you decide not to do that, and God ruins your country, ruins your land, ruins your economy, ruins your life, breaks your heart, destroys the entire civilization, and he gets his kids back anyway. How do you want to do it? And the Pharaoh says, give me the best you got. He says, okay, dude, your way. So God sends the plagues, which was just a systematic destruction of the entire Egyptian society. One after another. He broke their economy. He broke their spirits. He broke their health. He broke their everything. He ruined their livestock. He ruined their land. He ruined their culture. He ruined the place. God swept through and destroyed the place in 10 steps. You never see that book, by the way, on Amazon, like the 10 ways to destroy an entire civilization. Like, you know, but it's right there in the book of Exodus. And what he does is basically, because Pharaoh was saying, I don't know who this God is, but I don't really care about him, and so I'm going to keep his kids. And God says, if you don't think I'm God, then I'm going to show you in no uncertain terms that your gods are not gods. So the Egyptians had all these gods. So the plagues were not just destroying Egypt. They were like God's little smackdown on all the Egyptian gods. Like, they had all these different, like, they had a god who was, the Nile River was a god. And so they worshiped the Nile. So God said, you think the river is a god? It's not. I'm God. I made the river. Watch this. Boom. The river is blood. The whole thing. All your water is blood. Every time you open up the taps and try to take a drink, it's sanguine. How do you like that? It's bloody. It's going to be nasty. Are you a vampire? I hope so, because that's the only way you're going to have fun. Except in Goshen. Because in Goshen, the Israelites had pure, clean water to drink. Because what God was doing was, he was ruining the Egyptian society. He was throwing a smackdown on all of their gods. And he was saying, these are my kids, and they're different. So all your water is blood. And all their water, guess what? Still water. They had a god that was like their god of fertility, which, like, if you wanted to have a kid, then you had to sacrifice to this god of fertility or whatever, and, you know, and then this god would give you kids. And the god of fertility was shaped like a frog for some reason. And so God is like, I don't know what you people, I don't know how y'all came up with this, but if you think frogs are so sexy, then here you go. Frogs everywhere. Frogs in your kitchen, frogs in your car, frogs in the, you know, in the bathroom, frogs in your bed. Anybody still think frogs are sexy? It's like, are we done with that yet? I mean, just frogs everywhere, except, guess where? Goshen. No frogs for the Israelites. Just frogless. It's a frogless society. It was awesome. And it didn't matter what it was. If it was gnats or flies, he gave them boils and diseases and just locusts that ruined the crops. Everything was ruined. Hail, just everything that came. It destroyed Egypt. Israelites, kicking it. Frogless, hailless, boilless, just gnatless, the whole thing. It was just party time in Goshen. Everybody's talking to their travel agent. It was a whole thing. But, like, you know, how do I get there? And so God just keeps going, and Pharaoh keeps saying, you can go, and then, no, you can't go. So he changes his mind, so God has to keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. They had one of their favorite gods was Ra, the god of the sun god. And God said, you think that Ra, you think the sun is a god? The sun is not a god. I am God. I made the sun. Watch this. Boom, it's off. He just turned the sun off. He said, in fact, light doesn't even actually come from the sun. Light comes from me. Watch this. You can't light a candle. You can't burn a match. You can't start a fire. You have no light. You can't make light happen. It was so dark, they couldn't even, no flashlights worked. Nothing worked. Except, guess what? In Goshen, they still had sunlight. People are thinking, how do you have light? And God was saying, light doesn't come from the sun. It comes from me. And these are my kids. So guess what? They get light. No light for you, 1 year. Light for them. So they kept going. Pharaoh kept changing his mind. And finally, God pulls out the big guns. The last one. The worst one. He told Moses, he said, there's something coming. It's coming in a week. And I need you to get ready for it. There's never been a day like the day that's coming. In Egypt, there are going to be sounds that have never been heard. There are going to be mothers, not weeping, not wailing. They're going to be screaming. They're going to be losing their minds. The entire country is going to lose their collective mind. Because I'm sending a destroyer, and it's going to take all the firstborn boys. We're talking firstborn crickets. Firstborn cats, firstborn squirrels, firstborn dogs, firstborn cows, goats, chickens, everything. All the way up to the little boys in the houses. Firstborn boys, firstborn men. The Pharaoh's own firstborn son. They're all going to be gone. All their hearts are going to stop beating in one night. He said, Moses, it's happening in a week. Now, up to this point, you guys have been different. You haven't had to do anything. I'm going to give you something to do this time. What I want you to do is, I want you to go out and get a one-year-old baby lamb and bring it into your house. And it has to live in your house for a week. At the end of the week, on the last day of the week, at twilight, the man of the house is going to take that little baby lamb, slit its throat. You got to catch all the blood. Listen to me, Moses. You got to do this. Write it down. You got to catch all the blood. You got to skin the lamb. You got to slaughter it. You got to roast it. You got to eat the thing. You got to eat all of it. If your family can't eat it all, burn it all up. Don't let any of it be around in the morning. Okay? When you eat it, I want you, it's going to sound weird. I want you to eat it with your shoes on your feet, your coat on your back, your pack around your shoulder. I want you to stand up while you eat. Why? Because you're leaving tonight. Let the little baby lamb live in your house for a week. And then at the end of the week, you got to do this thing. I have to pause for a second and say that I'm really thankful that my family wasn't part of that whole thing. Because if I had walked in, you know, on a Friday with a little baby, one-year-old, perfect, spotless lamb, the first thing that would have happened in the first 30 seconds is that my daughters and my son would have run up to me and it would be squeals of delight. It finally happened. Dad got us a dog. That's not a dog. What is that? It's a lamb. That'll do. You know? And then immediately they would say, look at its little curly wool. It's so cute. I'm going to name him Curly. And then they would be playing with Curly and sleeping with Curly and giving him water and feeding him and then drawing pictures of Curly. There would be drawings of Curly the lamb all over my house. There would be little books about Curly. There would be songs about Curly. And the first thing in the morning when you wake him up, how's Curly? Where is he? They would go find him. This little lamb, in that one little week, everybody in my house would have fallen in love with this lamb. And then there's that point where you say, you need to say goodbye to Curly. Why? Why do I have to say goodbye to Curly? Because he's not going to be here tomorrow. Why? I have to kill the lamb. What? I'm sorry. I know you love the lamb. I have to do it. And Christy would have to hold its body down, and I would have to hold its head. And then the dad had to slit the throat and catch the blood. And the little legs are kicking, and then they kick slower and slower, and then they stop. And he's gone. Curly's gone. And then while she's getting him ready to roast, I would have this blood, a bowl full of blood. And they had to take this plant that was like a paintbrush. And God said, paint the blood on your doorframe. Now, I have to, you know, if I was one of these Israelite guys and Moses was like telling us what to do, I would be like, everybody shut up. What did you say? Stop talking. I've got to take notes. Hey, if you don't stop, I'm going to take you out, dude. And then you're just writing down notes. Okay, so would you say that again? I can't remember. How much of the doorframe exactly do we need to paint? Because here's the deal. I'm a firstborn son. My parents had two kids. I have a little sister. I'm the firstborn son. My dad is a firstborn son. I want to take the notes. He had a little brother and an older sister. He's the firstborn son. I want to make sure he does it right. We have Jack. I've got to get this right. I'd be taking the notes. I'd be writing it down. There'd be houses like mine where me and Jack and my dad would all be fighting for the bowl and the brush. I'm painting it on there. No, you're not. I'm painting it on there. Son, hand me the brush. You know? I mean, my whole life, anytime there was, I have to take an aside here and say that anytime there was like home improvement stuff to be done, you knew that my dad wasn't going to be doing the painting. There's nothing he hates worse than painting. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've heard, I'd rather take a beating than paint. He literally would like to just take a beating rather than paint. But on that night, he would be painting, baby. He'd be painting the doorframe. Because all night long, don't you know that firstborn sons and mothers of firstborn sons and sisters of firstborn sons and wives of firstborn sons and brothers of firstborn sons were sitting there all night long going, did it work? Did it work? Did it work? Is it going to work? Maybe we should paint another coat. Is there any left? All night long, did it work? Did it work? And then finally, when the black sky turns a little bit blue and it gets a little bit lighter and a little bit lighter and those first rays of sun come over the horizon and mothers are grabbing little boys going, thank God it worked. It worked. You're still here. We're still here. And all night long, while they were waiting and wondering if it worked, they heard screaming and wailing and mothers losing their minds all over Egypt. And God said, you're going to hear sounds you have never heard. He said, it's right there in the book of Exodus. It says, but among the houses of the Israelites, not even a dog will bark. Everybody's going to be screaming, but not y'all. Y'all are going to be silent all night long. So the sun came up and they made it. It worked. And then God told them to do a really weird thing, a thing that none of us would want to do. He said, I want you to go to the homes of the Egyptians and I want you to knock on their doors. And you're thinking, let's just leave them alone. They've had a hard enough night, right? And God said, no, go to their houses, knock on the doors. When they come to the doors and they say, what do you people want? Say, I want your money. Jewelry, money, whatever you got. Let's have it. And you're like, is that in there? It's in there. It says they plundered the Egyptians. The Egyptians were in their homes, scared to death. They opened the doors. What do you want? Do you want rings, necklaces? Just take it and get out of here. We want you people out. Take everything. What do you want? The computer? What do you want? Just have it all. Just leave. God had plans for all that gold and silver and bronze. He had plans for all that stuff. He was going to use it. So they left. And they made it all the way to this lake, this gigantic lake. And Pharaoh changed his mind again because God hardened his heart. He sent the whole army behind him. And you guys know this, but we got to all be on the same page, okay? So he sends this whole army out, and all their hearts are hardened. And all night long, they were afraid. But then dads who were in the army were angry that their sons were gone. And they're pursuing. And it's like that guy all his friends are holding him back, you know? Let me at him. He's about to start a fight, and you had an army full of men like that who had grieving wives and broken hearts. And God came down like a fence of fire in between the Egyptian army and the Israelites. And you know those Egyptian soldiers were screaming and cursing. And wait till this fire goes away. Just wait. We're going to take you out. They were screaming all night long. It's funny because whenever you watch the movies, like, you know, Moses raises his hands, he sticks his staff in the water, and the water just goes kaboom. It takes like 3.5 minutes or, you know, however long the score is going to be, the musical score for that scene. And it's all really cool and the CGI is great and everything. But it says in the book of Exodus that it took all night. And Moses told the people, stand still. So you have this fence of fire. On one side, you have angry, broken-hearted soldiers screaming, cursing, ready to fight. On the other side, you have God's kids standing stock still, silent as a stone, waiting on the water to move. And then they walked through as on dry ground. The Egyptians tried to come in, and they were swept away, drowned. Okay. You're going through a hard time. It's dark. It's confusing. It's painful. There are noises you don't know what to do with. You're disoriented. You don't know what way is up. You don't know what God is doing. And I know that so many of you have gone through times like that, and some of you you're going to, or you might be in one right now, and you don't know what's happening, and you feel like the only way out of the dark is to get out of the dark, to stop going through this. Some of you, you've had friends abandon you. Some of you, you've had problems at work you can't explain. Some of you have health things that you're afraid of. Some of you have things that I couldn't understand, pains and suffering and problems that nobody in this room knows the depth of how much it affects you. And you're trying to figure out, why should I hang on? And the author of the book of Hebrews says, why should you hang on? You should hang on because Moses kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood. So that when the destroyer took out the firstborn of the Egyptians, he didn't take out the Israelites. You should hang on because the people passed through by faith through a lake on dry ground, although the Egyptians were drowned. And you're like, what does that mean, dude? Why is that the key I need to hang on? What are you saying to me? And I've been thinking about this all week. And I think what he's saying to us is, when it's dark and confusing and painful and all you want to do is run away, you need to stay in it and hang on. Hang on to your faith in Christ. Why? Because you're different. You're different. You're not like other people. You're God's kids. You're different to Him. All those things that happened to the Egyptians, and it didn't happen to the Israelites. All of that stuff that happened on the night of the Passover, and they were silent as a stone. They walked through a lake on the dry ground, but the Egyptians were drowned. He's saying over and over again, don't you remember? Don't you remember that you're different? You're different? And you're like, what does that mean? I still don't get it. What are you saying to me? on this Mother's Day, you know, I'll never forget those moments when my kids were born. Potsy and I were talking to the guys in the jail this week, and I asked them, how many of you guys have kids? And almost all of them did. And I said, okay, you guys that have kids, how many of you were there, like in the room when your kids were born? And all of them that had kids were there. And when I asked that question, their eyes started to kind of fill up. Their eyes started to get wet. And I said, do you remember that moment? Do you remember that moment when your baby was born and you saw them for the first time? And it's awesome when jailbirds cry. And they started to get those glassy eyes. And I'll never forget that moment. Like I said, when Nora was born, it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I've never seen anything like that before. And as soon as it happened, it was like, that was awesome. And I felt like screaming. I felt like it was the Super Bowl. I felt like, can you believe that just happened? That was awesome. Did anybody see that? And like, you know, nurses are walking around. I need Apgar scores. I need, you know, measurements. Somebody move the baby over here. And I'm saying, time out, everybody stop. Did you see? That was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I looked at this little baby and I'm holding her. And then they handed her to Christy. And I'm looking in her beautiful face. And I'm just thinking, you made it. You made it. We've been waiting for you. You're so awesome. Look at you. You're so beautiful. And we've been waiting and we have this room ready and we have all these toys. And I know you don't know what that means yet, but it's going to be awesome. And I know you don't know how awesome kisses are, but you're going to get a million of them. And it's going to be so sweet and it's going to be so fun. And you're mine. And I've been waiting on you. And I love you. That moment, I'll never forget the way that felt. You know, I've always thought that like when we get to heaven, and we finally run our race, and we get to the end of it, and we show up in heaven. We close our eyes on this world, and we open our eyes on the face of the Lord. And I've always pictured it like, you know, God is sitting on a throne, and he's awesome, and he's so sweet and everything. But he says to us, like, welcome, well done, my good and faithful servant. And it's all very, you know, throny and cloudy and all that kind of stuff. And this week, I don't know if I'm right about this. It's total speculation. So, theologians, take a break. But this week I've started to wonder if maybe it's not more like a delivery room and it's not a lot noisier. I've wondered if when we close our eyes on this world and we open them in the next, there our Father is going to be in scrubs with a mask on going, you made it! You made it. You're here. I've been waiting for you. You're so awesome. That was the most awesome thing I've ever seen. And he's turning around to angels going, you guys stop flying around. Did you see that? That was awesome. Have you ever in your life seen anything like that for every single one of us? You made it. You're home. I know you don't know exactly what that means yet, but you're going to love it. We're different. We're God's kids. It's sometimes dark. It's sometimes confusing. It's disorienting. There's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of squeezing. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of mess. We're sometimes upside down. We don't know what's happening, but don't let go. And the reason you need to not let go is because you're different than everybody else. Because you're God's kid. And he's waiting on you to get home. You're almost there. We're almost there. I don't know when it's going to be. I know we're closer today than we were yesterday. And the reason that we're different, the reason that we're his kids, it's not because we're so awesome. I mean, when my kids were born, I always felt like, objectively, these are the most beautiful babies that have ever happened. That's not an opinion. That's just an objective truth. Look at these children. They're fantastic, you know? And everybody feels that way, but you know, it's not that we're different and we're his kids because we're so awesome or we've lived this thing so well or we're so, you know, we're so pure and beautiful and stuff like that. It has nothing to do with that. We're different because a way was made for us when there was no way. We're different because a lamb has come into our life, a spotless lamb. And we've fallen in love with him and he gave his blood for us. That's why we're different. In a minute, we're going to take communion. We're going to take bread and the cup together. And that's what we remember. That I can hang on through this thing. No matter how dark it is, no matter how painful it is, no matter how much suffering or how much confusion or how disorienting it is, I can hang on through this. Because I'm different. I'm God's kid. Because blood was shed for me. I'm just being born. I'm getting born. At the end of this, I'm going to be delivered. It's going to be awesome. We invite you to come and to take the bread and the cup. And you don't have to be a member of our church. If you're visiting for the very first time, we invite you to come. The only thing that we ask is that you know in your heart that you've accepted Jesus as your Lord, as your Savior, as the one who paid for you so that you could be His kid. Will you come?
For more information about Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, including staff blogs, ministries we love and support, or just to connect with us, you can find us on the web at c3oakridge.org.